Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, and this is episode 22 covering the mysterious disappearance of Sabrina Eisenberg, a 5-month-old baby who garnered national attention when she reportedly vanished from her family's Valrico, Florida home in the middle of the night on November 24, 1997. In the eyes of some, it was a tragic abduction where somebody stole an infant from her crib with the intention of raising her, or at least selling her to somebody else who would. For others, however, specifically the police, something more sinister had seemingly taken place. They believed Sabrina's parents, Steve and Marlene Eisenberg, murdered the child and disposed of the body before staging the incident as a kidnapping. But 20 years later, we still have no answers. Obviously, it's an incredibly intriguing case, but one that offers very little in the way of evidence. In those situations, I like to examine both sides of the coin by way of a common theme. And in this event, that theme is going to be manipulation. Each party is going to try to manipulate the circumstances to redistribute notions of guilt. We simply need to note the totality of manipulation initiated by either side to understand the probability of guilt in this situation. So, we'll head down that path and see where it takes us. But first, I want to take a moment to give a shout to my newest supporter on Patreon, Steve Kaminsky, from the podcast Baked in Awake. Steve's been a big supporter of the show, and I'm very thankful to have him along for the journey. So thank you very much, Steve. As always, the rest of you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and I greatly appreciate your 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. Okay, so moving along. It's after 11 p.m. on November 23rd, 1997, and Marlene Eisenberg supposedly checks on baby Sabrina before going to bed. The couple's other two kids, Monica, 4, and William, 8, are also asleep in their bedrooms. Now, Marlene says the child is sleeping in the crib at the time, and that's when she retires for the night. When she awakens the next morning between 6 and 7 a.m., prompted by a loud fish tank, which I assume means the sound of the filter running, she goes downstairs to the kitchen to begin her normal routine. It's at this time Marlene looks into the laundry room attached to the kitchen and notices the door leading into the garage is unlocked. After realizing they left the exterior door to the garage wide open the night before, the one that faces the driveway and street, Marlene hurries upstairs to check on Sabrina. Of course, the baby is missing from her crib, along with a blanket, neither of which are ever seen again. So, Marlene screams at the horrifying sight, which wakes up her husband Steve, who comes running. Now, all of this seems like a normal circumstance for a kidnapping. The parents got caught with their pants down, and somebody swooped in at the opportunity, whether it was intended as an abduction for a ransom, murder, sexual assault, or all three. But that's before they changed their story. In fact, it's going to happen a few times, starting with Marlene ditching the noisy fish tank as the reason she woke up. But we won't even go there yet. First, we'll ask this question. Why did Marlene scream in belief that her baby had been kidnapped before making any attempt to locate the child within the house? I was baffled by this, so I asked a few people I know who have multiple children how they would react initially in a circumstance where they found a baby missing from a crib while other young children were in the house. Not surprisingly, and without my leading them with more info, they all said they would be inclined to check with the other kids before freaking out because it's perfectly plausible one of your other children might take the baby from the crib. I mean, that's what kids do. They take shit without permission. If they're 3 years old, it's a cookie, and if they're 16, it's a car. But you can't just jump to the conclusion somebody's been kidnapped without searching the confines of a home that contains other living creatures, including a dog. You know, their dog Brownie, who didn't bark during the night when the intruder came in the house, according to Steve and Marlene, because Brownie never barked at anybody. Unfortunately for them, neighbor Scott Middleton, a former Tampa cop, said, quote, "Brownie barked at everybody. She always barked. She was a noisy dog. I don't ever remember her being quiet." End quote. Now just think of the magnitude of the disparity between his statements and the Eisenberg's assertion that the dog never barked. Yet how do we know who to believe? Easy. Steve Eisenberg tells us with his next action that we can trust Scott Middleton. So while Marlene calls 911, the first thing Steve does is head over to talk to neighbor Scott Middleton. Essentially, what we should believe is that the Eisenbergs felt the two most helpful actions at that point, one taken by each parent, would be in this order of importance. A, calling the cops, and B, alerting Scott Middleton. But what we're already starting to learn is that this strategy is going to backfire. And the problem has very much to do with the way our brains process denial. Denial is attained by way of continuously asserting truths which don't actually correlate to the result of our previous actions. So, if you get wasted and make a fool of yourself at the company holiday party on a Friday night, and then come in Monday morning acting as though it never happened, you're probably going to get some funny looks and whispers. At the core of this is humor, and that humor is related to the fact you've abandoned reality in order to cope with mistakes. And this is where we point the flashlight in the faces of the Eisenbergs, because as I just mentioned a few minutes ago, cold cases without evidence should be examined in terms of theme. So, if you abandon reality in order to cope with your mistakes, what you end up doing is indulging in something very specific and obvious, which is this. Convenience. It's easier to go into the office Monday morning and pretend everything's fine than it is to go to each person's desk individually and ask if you should apologize because you blacked out from the booze at the party and can't remember if you offended them. So, what we can say at this point is that, regardless of the method by which it transpired, Sabrina Eisenberg was missing from her crib on the morning of November 24, 1997. And if our theme is convenience, in terms of the denial her parents are already displaying in the retelling of their story, by making a barking dog silent, then their guilt could essentially be predicated upon the specific nature of the crime following suit. Now let's take a look. This is what the perpetrator would have to accomplish. The first step would be showing up to learn of this opportunity on a night when the Eisenbergs left not only the garage door wide open, but the door leading into the house from it unlocked. The kidnapper would have to trek upstairs to the baby's room, not waking anyone or stirring the dog in the process. The baby would then have to be removed without waking her in order to prevent her from making a fuss. At that point, the perpetrator goes downstairs, walks past the dog holding the smallest, youngest member of the pack, and heads out the door, escaping into the night with Sabrina Eisenberg, who's gone forever. This was clearly a crime of convenience. It didn't involve violence, coercion, forced entry, or anything else that would prove the presence of another person inside the home that night. A phantom simply walked into the home, snatched the baby, and cruised out without being detected. We have a single shoe print on the mat underneath the crib that hasn't been identified, and some fingerprints near doorways in the home that have also not been matched to anyone. But this doesn't mean they belong to the kidnapper. They certainly could, but in reality it's a house where people come and go. The prints could belong to anybody. They weren't lifted in the context of a specific action, meaning, for example, that the prints near the doorway don't indicate they're part of an attempt to break in the home, in the same way the shoe print near the crib doesn't prove a kidnapper stole the child. I mean, if the police were to come to all of our homes right now to dust for fingerprints, I have no doubt some of us would be left baffled by the findings. We open our doors to contractors, people making deliveries, landlords, the neighbors picking up their children, and many other scenarios. Our homes are basically dustbins with DNA and fingerprints getting endlessly transferred from one place to another. As you've probably heard me discuss previously, the detection of foreign DNA at a crime scene in a home should not be grounds for establishing innocence on behalf of the family members. The JonBenet Ramsey case is probably the most well-known example of this propensity for wanting to believe DNA is definitive simply by default of its presence. Another total disgrace I covered is the murder of Meredith Kircher, where the DNA of others became inorganically mixed with her DNA by way of ineptitude present in the collection process and thereby falsely created a picture of guilt for Amanda Knox. So, to summarize, at the time 911 is called, there is actually no evidence that somebody entered the Eisenberg home and abducted Sabrina. It's a fact that Sabrina is missing, but Marlene jumps right to the conclusion she's been kidnapped. It's absurd. Yes, I know what you might be thinking, that it's perfectly natural to believe your child's been kidnapped when she's missing from her crib and nobody in the house can explain why. But that's supposed to take place after you notice the baby is missing. If we recount Marlene's initial statement to police about her actions that morning, what we learn is that she went to the kitchen, and whatever action she was about to take, she decided to forego when she saw the door to the garage was unlocked. At that point, she abandons the endeavor in the kitchen due to concern for the door being unlocked and goes straight to Sabrina's room to check on her. Yet, the Eisenbergs will tell police later that day that they always left that interior door leading into the garage unlocked because the kids came in and out that way all day long. So, it would be safe to assume that the Eisenbergs were not only normally unfazed by leaving the door unlocked at all times, but that they wouldn't have any particular reason for suddenly believing it was a problem on this morning. They go on to try to convince us that the reason it concerned Marlene so much is because the exterior garage door was wide open. But Marlene wouldn't have known the exterior garage door was open unless she went to the interior door out of concern in the first place when she saw it unlocked, and then checked outside it to see the exterior door open. That's a lot of concern in investigation for a person who goes on to swear to police that the family has never used the home's alarm system and that they never lock their doors. Of course, I'm probably not hiding my feelings about this case very well. I believe the Eisenbergs are guilty as they come, even in the absence of physical evidence or even any overwhelming circumstantial evidence. Now, some people get upset when I talk about this, but something I find very important in the process of analyzing people's actions is attempting to gauge their approximate level of intelligence and also the specific type of intelligence they possess as it pertains to talent, career, etc. And the one thing I immediately notice about these two is that neither of them embody what I would consider a creative personality, somebody inclined to artistic pursuits. Steve Eisenberg looks more like a guy who would be doing your taxes than somebody who'd be performing in a musical on Broadway. And Marlene ran an exercise program for babies and toddlers, so we also get a decent portrayal of her personality and skill set. Ultimately, the two of them will end up in Maryland working together in real estate. Accordingly, the police end up getting numerous beginnings to this tale from Steve and Marlene, where small details reveal big gaps in consistency. The reason for this is that they're shitty storytellers. Here's why. This story doesn't start with the baby being missing. If Marlene and Steve are guilty of foul play in Sabrina's death, the best thing they could have done in the retelling of their story is to say Marlene woke up naturally, then went to Sabrina's room as she normally would, and saw the baby gone. Instead, what we get is a story that rationalizes Marlene's behavior for believing a kidnapping occurred. But the problem is that every detail she uses to rationalize the story directly conflicts with what they tell the cops about their normal habits, as we just discussed. So by default, one side of these diametrically opposed ideas must be false. It's a lie, plain and simple. In that light, what we should then do is decide if we're more inclined to believe the Eisenbergs' assertions about their everyday life or the behavior they offer in statements to police on the morning where their daughter just so happened to be missing from their home. If we examine both of these situations closely, the parallel we can find between the two is that everyday life is repetitive and consistent, occurring to us in a span of a 7-day week with 24-hour days that's encapsulated in a 365-day year. Except sometimes, on rare occasions, such as a leap year, it changes, which doesn't even qualify as an anomaly because February 29 only happens once a year every 4 years. It's such a rare occurrence, in fact, that its singularity renders it isolated from ever becoming a pattern. That's exactly the nature of Sabrina's disappearance. Steve and Marlene are pretending it's leap year, that all the rules of their behavior can suddenly change on this day because it's different than any other in the sense that Sabrina was kidnapped. This offering from the Eisenbergs will eventually become so muddled in terms of what actually transpired that morning that Steve will later tell the story on Larry King Live to a national audience and generalize to an extent that it sounds like he and Marlene have totally given up on trying to concoct a decent tale. And the problem, as I just mentioned, is their lousy storytelling. They keep trying to start the story before the kidnapping and fail in bringing consistency to the event. Any decent writer knows the story has to start with the mother waking up and finding the baby missing from the crib. Because if it doesn't, what you then end up doing is creating a scenario justifying why it's about to happen. If we were an audience and the film showed Marlene go to the kitchen and prepare the kids' breakfast while brewing coffee, we'd all be so bored we'd walk out of the theater. Patsy and John Ramsey fell victim to the same thing with JonBenet's murder. They floundered in attempts to maintain a consistent version of their actions between their daughter's suspected time of death and when they called 911. Patsy offered numerous versions of what transpired between waking up and finding the ransom note, each of which was quite different. This transpired for the same reason. She's not a very good storyteller. Again, had Patsy said she woke naturally and went right downstairs to the kitchen as she normally would, at which point she found the ransom note, police wouldn't have as much reason to press her. And here's the thing. The police lean on people hard about seemingly insignificant events in the timeline because inconsistencies are so prone to revealing lies. Most people who commit murder are thinking about how to avail themselves of the perception of guilt in the eyes of the police and others, and not about whether they woke up due to a loud fish tank or any other mundane detail of the morning. The reason police do this is they can ensure that you'll lie if you have to. And if you do, those lies will be revealed by way of inconsistencies. So, in keeping with our theme of convenience, Steve and Marlene have lied about their actions that morning in order to accommodate the convenience of appearing innocent by making up a story that utilizes behavior conflicting with their everyday life. At the heart of this conflict between the two, the discord, is that you can't write real life. It happens and never lies in its indifference to your plight. On the other hand, stories are fantastical, born of what we desire our situation to be rather than what it is. We have to create them, to bring them to life on paper or on a screen. And trust me, this is a very messy process, one rife with problems that cause writers to produce draft after draft until finally something that will never be finished seems acceptable enough to qualify as truth in the reader's eyes. And do you know the sole element that must be combed through a million times over and eradicated before you can establish believability? Inconsistencies. Stories fail in the believability department specifically due to inconsistency. Once an audience member calls bullshit on a character's behavior as being inauthentic, the entire story comes crashing down like a house of cards. And that's because we do one thing in our consumption of stories, and one thing only. Seek the truth. So when you bullshit the police with the notion that you're innocent despite inconsistent behavior, they're going to hammer you for it because you've perpetrated a lie against the essence of their humanity. And that's why, even 2 years later, in 1999, the police are going to raid the Eisenbergs' home, entering with a battering ram, and ultimately detain Steve in what he describes as a strip search before being temporarily jailed, even in light of the fact that no physical evidence will ever arise in the case. The Eisenbergs go on to paint this as a gross injustice, one that's never-ending and simply can't be justified. What's evident to me, however, is that they caused this result from the start by creating a situation where it was apparent they were lying, but one that was also absent of evidence that would prove such in court. 20 years later, nothing has changed. The police still believe the Eisenbergs are guilty, and the Eisenbergs still claim they're innocent. So, let's take a look at what happens after Marlene sees Sabrina missing from the crib. There's an account that she simply screamed, and then the story has also been recounted where she screams specifically for Steve. So, which is it? Of course, she also pees herself at that moment, which is perfectly understandable given the shocking nature and magnitude of a missing baby. But again, just as the opening scene to this story was poorly written, this one follows suit in exactly the same manner. Instead of checking to see if the baby is possibly with one of the other two kids, she's definitively decided her child is gone. This has reached the point of being absolute in her mind, so crushing in its finality that she screamed and lost control of her bodily functions in the blink of an eye. And now, again, in both accounts of her screaming, with and without Steve's name, the implication is still that she's calling for Steve to come, which he corroborates, saying he ran to the room and saw the baby missing from the crib. At this point, Steve claims they frantically looked around the room and under the crib for Sabrina. And this is where they get caught with their pants down again. They have two small children between the ages of 4 and 8 in the house, and the unlocked door has caused Marlene to check on Sabrina, but not them. Not even under the pretense of just seeing if the baby is with them. William and Monica simply aren't a part of this story. No one is concerned for their safety in all of this. Now, I'm not a mother, but it seems to me that if a baby is missing and you have two other young children in the home, your instincts, one way or another, are going to drive you to their bedrooms in an effort to ensure the well-being of all of the kids. Children of all ages are abducted, for various reasons, and there simply was not any specific reason for Marlene to have been overwhelmingly concerned about the baby, at the exclusion of her other children. They were equally fair game. The fact of the matter is that she chose to go to Sabrina's room first. Why? Now, the easy answer is that you'd naturally be most protective of the baby. But therein lies the truth in the two words, most protective. We don't get a series of visits to the children's bedrooms to assess the totality of the situation before assuming the worst. And it seems to me the reason is because it wasn't necessary. They knew the other kids were safe, and that Sabrina wasn't with them. Eventually, however, after searching Sabrina's room, the Eisenbergs finally round up their other children. But, much like the dog and the parents, they didn't see or hear anything during the night. So, we have five humans and a dog sleeping inside a house, and someone reportedly enters the home and removes the infant without detection. For two decades and counting, there is still no intruder and still no Sabrina. Those are two things that have been consistent and convenient. And the Eisenbergs maintain to this day that they believe Sabrina is alive and has been living with another family who desperately wanted a child of their own. The Eisenbergs have never wavered from that. But strangely, the only significant thing they've done to try to locate her over the years is to release age-progressed photos of what she would look like at that time. But let's think about this for a second. It's no more probable Sabrina was kidnapped for the purpose of a family acquiring a child than it is for someone to enter the home and steal the kid for purposes such as ransom, sexual assault, and murder, among others. But instead of engaging in endless searches for their daughter's possible location and fate, as many parents in their position do, the impetus for their actions is simply to create a perception that Sabrina is still alive by maintaining that another family wanted her and continuing to produce photos of what she would look like. But this is a magic show. It's the saw going through the box while the woman inside is screaming in fear of being cut in half. It's nothing more than an illusion. Here's how we know. By neglecting to consider things such as murder, the Eisenbergs immediately, and by default, remove themselves from the suspect list, and thereby are not expected to contribute to any type of investigative means that might render the truth about their daughter. By examining the incident in the context of foul play, the truth will always lie in what happened leading up to the morning of November 24, 1997, so the public and investigators want to focus on that. The Eisenbergs, on the other hand, seek to project this incident perpetually into the future by suggesting Sabrina is still alive. So, not only does that alleviate them from the possibility of having committed a crime, but it also pulls the focus away from the morning of November 24, 1997, and places it in the context of today. That puts Steve and Marlene in the role of long-suffering victims, whereas admitting that Sabrina's disappearance could have resulted in murder would render them permanent suspects in the absence of physical evidence. And the situation in which you would be most likely to try to perpetuate this falsehood would be one where it isn't possible for the finger to ever be pointed anywhere else because you're guilty and there's no proof anybody outside of your home took the baby. This is another example of convenience. The Eisenbergs have ignored investigation and possibility in favor of utilizing perception as fact in a matter where, quite frankly, if they're telling the truth, they don't know shit. Really, if they're telling the truth, they should be throwing their hands up like, we don't know what happened. She could be alive or dead, living with a normal family, or chained to a wall in a dungeon suffering a horrifying existence. We simply don't know. Yet the Eisenbergs try to manipulate emotion by making this appear as though they might just be grieving parents who don't want to face the reality of what somebody did to their daughter and need to believe she's alive in order to proceed in life. It's how they're able to justify this falsely staunch belief she's still roaming the earth. She isn't, and was already long since dead when Marlene made that 911 call. If that wasn't the case, these people would still be looking for justice and talking about how angry they are the police tried to railroad them into charges for something they didn't do. They would want to know the truth, find Sabrina's abductor, and stuff it in the cops' faces. This is a regular occurrence with victims' families. They want answers. But the Eisenbergs don't. They say they've moved on to raise their other children the best they could, which is interesting because that's exactly what you would do if you killed your baby and covered it up in hopes that you could salvage your life. They've asserted that they hope Sabrina was raised in a loving family. Seriously? It's almost 2018. Technology has progressed to the point that you could do more to find her. The internet is full of mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, and everybody else who are friends or family of victims demanding answers from cases that have long since gone cold. Notice that the Eisenbergs only look for their daughter by releasing photos, but don't make any further attempt to establish who the kidnapper might have been. That specifically means that they assume the truth of a kidnapping where Sabrina went on to flourish, rather than considering somebody might have hurt her and still needs to be brought to justice. So again, we need to ask ourselves, why have they indulged this convenience of believing she's alive, when the obvious truth is that we actually don't know? Now, getting back to the day of the crime, investigators arrive at the Eisenbergs' Valrico, Florida home after the 911 call to find that it's a mess. Not in the sense that there was some type of disturbance there. Rather, it was just dirty. Some people suggest this is indicative of neglect on their part and might give us a clue as to how Sabrina died. But I think neglect is an obvious element that resides right on the surface of this case anyway. I mean, the doors were unlocked, the alarm system was off, and the garage door was wide open. I'm not sure dishes in the sink is any more damning than any of those things. Or is it? You see, plenty of Americans keep a filthy house. And it's not really cause for concern beyond making sure it's clean next time you have guests. But if we introduce context into the situation, what we have here are two working parents with three young children, which suggests they might have fallen behind in their cleaning habits because they were overwhelmed. And people who are overwhelmed become stressed out, depressed, and irritable, among other things. We're more so predisposed to taking hasty actions when we feel emotionally unstable. The Eisenbergs were also having financial troubles, certainly something that doesn't get any better with the introduction of another child into the family. In fact, the cost of maintaining that child's life immediately becomes symbolic of the struggle, and when a baby is crying while you're miserable, it's hard to maintain your cool. So from that standpoint, the condition of the home does emote a sense of overall neglect, with doors being opened and unlocked, and the living space being dirty. But none of these things constitutes criminality. At most, we can call it bad judgment. Yet it also shows us that the family was not running a tight ship. Things were amiss. In fact, I have no doubt that if you took inventory of your own cleaning habits, you would find that you clean the most when you feel the best, and feel the best when you clean the most. It's cyclical, just like depression. So, if your house looks like shit and you're not doing anything about it, your mental state might very well be reflective of that notion. That's not an absolute, but when the cops say they made note of this upon entering the home, this is essentially their concern. Often the inside of your home and your mental state are conducive to one another. A perfectionist or someone with severe OCD might keep the place spotless, while someone with severe depression or simply living in a college fraternity house might exist under a heap of trash. The point is that the home being neat or clean is not, in and of itself, valuable. It's the context at play which provides the most insight. And what the context tells us here is that the condition of the Eisenbergs' home, from the open doors to the dirt, suggests neglect on the part of the parents. So if a baby disappears due to perceived neglect on the part of the parents, and there is no definitive evidence of a suspect available outside the home, then the most likely conclusion is that Sabrina Eisenberg is missing due to neglect on the part of her parents that took place inside the home. In that regard, the messy house is entirely relevant to our analysis, but certainly won't suffice as evidence in a courtroom. However, the police have a right to be suspicious about the presence of the filth due to its relation to potential neglect. Okay. So, the police are at the house, and Marlene is being interviewed about the details of what transpired that morning. According to her, however, what begins as an effort to learn who might have kidnapped her daughter quickly becomes a situation where the questions are turning the suspicion toward her and her husband. Yet what starts as a gut feeling for Marlene abruptly becomes a stark reality when a detective leans over toward her and quietly says that the cops think the couple was involved in their daughter's disappearance. If you're innocent, that's nothing less than a nightmare. You've lost a child, perhaps for good, and now the police are coming after you for an offense that is potentially going to destroy your family permanently and send your other children into foster care while you and your husband go to prison. That's crushing in a way that I can't even begin to fathom, except to say that what it would make me feel is specifically this: anger toward the police. I would be enraged, and I would fight back. I would challenge them to prove it by making myself as loud, visible, and obnoxious as possible. I would give them the hard drive on my computer, tell them the color of my underwear, and divulge every detail of my private and financial lives with two middle fingers extended the whole time to clearly say, go fuck yourselves. And the reason innocent people do this is because the restriction of freedom by way of injustice is highly offensive to our humanity. However, when guilty people claim innocence, what they often do is hide and then blame the police for their actions by saying they're being railroaded. Just as the Ramseys did to combat the Boulder PD, the Eisenbergs are about to engage the same practice down in Tampa. They're going to hire Barry Cohen, a very successful defense attorney from the area, who comes with a high price tag. The excuses in both cases for the parents hiring superstar legal representation is that they fully cooperated, but the cops wouldn't relent in zeroing in on them as the suspects. Breaking news. That's what they do if the story points to you as the guilty party. Investigations are very time-consuming, expensive, and often fruitless. If the cops think you're guilty, they're coming for you, even at the expense of other leads. And here's why. In every abduction or murder, the cops are going to receive an astoundingly disproportional number of false leads as opposed to those that pan out. So you don't go looking for the needle in the haystack in an investigation when the answer seems to be in front of your face, and the numbers support that notion. But that's what people like the Ramseys and Eisenbergs consistently claim should happen in an investigation. They always point to the police and say they ignored leads. But what they're telling you to do is value possibility more than probability because it favors them. The thing is, though, you don't need odds if you're innocent. You don't need to lawyer up. You don't need to stop talking. Those are all things you do if you're guilty. And another truth is this. If you do these things, then the cops truly aren't going to relent. Ever. What's probably going to happen is this thing ends up in court in front of a grand jury. And just as in the Ramsey case, that's what we get here. Because of that, we get a few parallels between the cases along the way. Now, while Marlene has already been explicitly told by the police that they don't believe her, Steve is on the phone with his brother recounting the tale. The brother advises him to hire legal representation at that point, and the cops are eavesdropping on the conversation because everyone in the house is waiting for a potential call demanding ransom. As I said previously, there's no clear indication of the abductor's ultimate motive, so planning for a ransom call is a wise move. Obviously, Steve is aware this is taking place and has been instructed to answer if and when somebody calls. Yet, instead of leaving the line entirely free so that his daughter's kidnappers would be able to reach him, he's talking to his brother seeking advice about his defense. Of course, that's only somewhat suspicious, as it's reasonable for someone to get rattled by the police making assertions of guilt. But then there are things like this. While Steve is on the phone with his brother discussing his legal options, police notice the call waiting beeps not once, but twice as somebody else is trying to call the Eisenberg home. But guess what? Steve ignores it. He doesn't answer two prompts from call waiting, despite the fact his daughter has seemingly been abducted, in the same way John and Patsy Ramsey didn't respond when the time had passed that their daughter's kidnapper was supposed to call about the ransom. The only reason to not show concern is if the story is fabricated and the child is dead. That's the only reason for the occurrence of such a reaction. Otherwise, you would be exploding with anxiety waiting for the phone to ring, your heart pounding every time it did. The Ramseys and Eisenbergs attempt to negate the fallout from this behavior in a similar manner. The Ramseys by saying they weren't sure if the ransom note was left before or after midnight, so they thought perhaps the call was coming the next day, while the Eisenbergs hold to the notion that they believe the kidnapping was perpetrated with the sole intention of acquiring a baby to raise and didn't expect a ransom call. Notice that in both of these situations, the parents have decided they know exactly what happened, without evidence, and won't budge from that stance. Which is a complete and total hypocrisy because, meanwhile, they're accusing the police of doing the same to them by not looking at other suspects. Steve Eisenberg didn't answer the phone at his house after his daughter had been reportedly kidnapped, because he was discussing his legal defense. If that isn't a revelation of character, I'm not sure what is. And this is what is terribly obvious about doing that. If it's her kidnapper, you don't need legal advice. So by default of the situation, your brain would set off bells and whistles when the call waiting beeps came through, because they're actually a potential solution for getting the cops to back off. So if you forego this opportunity to do so, and potentially save Sabrina's life, in favor of thinking of your defense, the statement you're making is that Sabrina is no longer alive, and you believe you could be held responsible. That's how you would behave if you killed her, not if you were trying to recover her. So for me, this is a massive red flag, as Steve's actions are entirely antithetical to his stated plight of recovering his daughter. Yet, as the years pass, the Eisenbergs keep a bedroom waiting for Sabrina's return, complete with updates like souvenirs they picked up for her on vacation. Again, this goes back to the theme of creating a perception. They've taken such care to make it look like they're truly still hoping desperately that Sabrina will come home, even to the point it's nearly pathetic. But when the phone rang the morning she was abducted, Steve ignored the call without a second thought. Literally. It beeped through twice. And by this time, neighbor and former cop Scott Middleton, who also commented on the dog barking quite often, is telling the authorities that Steve and Marlene seemed to be devoid of emotion that morning. And when I learned of this, I just had to stop to grin for a moment. What guilty people often do in situations involving high stakes is concentrate their initial efforts on proving their innocence to those who will cause them the greatest scrutiny about the situation, the reason being that these are influential people who will likely play a role in the outcome. So for Steve and Marlene, their first three points of contact that morning are the police, Scott Middleton, and Marlene's mother. And what we're going to recount here is a performance that's put on specifically for these three parties that will try to legitimize the version of events that just took place. But it backfires. Scott Middleton doesn't believe Steve Eisenberg, and the police don't buy the events either, while Marlene does nothing more than convey the story to her mother before saying she's too busy to talk and hangs up. So look at the ground they've covered in trying to immediately establish their innocence. They call the police, attempting to avail themselves of responsibility in the eyes of the law. They try to convince their most influential neighbor, symbolic of winning the support of the community, and then try to fool Marlene's mother and earn the support of the family. Now, this stalemate between police and the Eisenbergs drags on, much like what happened between the Ramseys and the Boulder PD. Neither side will relent in its stance regarding guilt or innocence, and with the Eisenbergs lawyered up, the cops are going to perpetrate a little manipulation of their own. So, to make a long story short, they basically lie to a judge in order to get permission to place wiretaps inside the couple's Florida home. When all is said and done, there are over 2,600 private conversations recorded from this effort, one in which police claim Steve and Marlene directly incriminate themselves in the death of their daughter. And maybe they did. But the cops screwed up while installing the listening devices. The quality was garbage. Worthless to a point, a judge ultimately agreed the claims the cops made were blatantly false. And this is truly painful because all indications are that Steve and Marlene didn't suspect it was taking place, and likely spoke freely to an extent we would have been able to establish guilt or innocence in a court of law. Regardless, Steve and Marlene are finally arrested in 1999 for charges related to lying to law enforcement in the investigation, and the evidence is brought before a grand jury. By this time, the Eisenbergs have left their Valrico, Florida home in favor of moving into Steve's childhood home in Maryland. They claim that the move was due to the fact that they wanted to raise their children with respect for law enforcement and felt they wouldn't be able to do so in light of what they were unfairly subjected to by Tampa police. Again, keeping in line with the Ramseys, the Eisenbergs skip town as though the problem is the police and things will be different elsewhere. But the reason the police always seem kinder in the new places is you didn't pull this stunt in their jurisdiction. If this had happened in Maryland, the police there would be asking why they didn't answer their call waiting, and their neighbor would be commenting that the dog always barks. Subsequently, we learn the real reason they go back to Steve's childhood home is that they're having financial problems. So as a standalone consideration, money concerns don't equate to murder, not by a long shot. But if you have several young children, a filthy house you can't manage, and a busy schedule, an empty bank account is going to make you feel hopeless on a regular basis, to say the least. And if we were to examine the Eisenbergs' lives in the context of things that consume their time, money, and patience, five-month-old Sabrina would surely be at the top of that list, and was expected to remain there for quite some time. I mean, having a child is a little bit like buying a new car. It's amazing, beautiful, and expensive, and the first 5 years of its life are going to require the utmost care to ensure the high monthly payments are ultimately worth the financial sacrifice. You want to handle it delicately, and make sure it arrives safely on the back end of your investment in one piece. But the first thing that negatively impacts used vehicles is what element? Neglect. Neglect causes cars to break down in the same way as humans. And the most delicate aspects of the vehicle are those which are most prone to malfunction, in the same way that the most delicate member of a family is most prone to the fallout from neglect taking place inside one's home. This is because these are the simultaneous aspects of the car, and of humans, that require the most maintenance. For instance, if you have an elderly in-law living with you who requires special care, or a toddler with a physical impairment of some type, you might be inclined to become frustrated by the time-consuming and exhaustive effort involved in accommodating this on a regular basis. It could get to you, and if you lost control, even for a moment, the consequences of doing so, based upon the person's fragile nature due to age, illness, or disability, could be permanent. This is one of the reasons Detective Steve Thomas held the belief that Patsy Ramsey was at fault for killing JonBenet, for the fact that the little girl wet her bed on a regular basis, and Patsy seemingly snapped under the pressure of holiday stress when it happened again. It was a theory that became quite popular, but was largely discredited by the findings of a grand jury that were later revealed in 2013. But I digress. The police moved forward with the conversations from these awful wiretaps as evidence, producing falsified transcripts to accompany them that were supposedly provided to the grand jury members as they listened to the recordings. What we know for sure, however, is that the grand jury returned with 6 indictments against the Eisenbergs, and at one point, Steve and Marlene actually took the 5th Amendment during questioning on the stand. Yes, you heard me correctly. A right that is specifically granted to people in a courtroom so as to allow them to not implicate themselves in a crime by answering a question is the strategy employed by the renowned legal team of two parents who claim absolute ignorance and innocence in the disappearance of their daughter. That really doesn't look good for them, and it's also not difficult to see why they were indicted despite the ludicrous transcripts that accompanied the botched recordings. Again, getting back to the theme of convenience, they just decided to not answer the questions, and it cost them. Projecting into the future, however, what we learn is that the charges will be dropped, and the Eisenbergs will receive a large settlement for their legal fees, albeit one that doesn't even cover the entirety of the sum. They each managed to pass a private polygraph, but that's only after Marlene's results came up inconclusive on 2 tests earlier conducted by police. Apparently, Steve passed his test with the cops, while Marlene remained under heavy suspicion for her results. Obviously, the national media wanted a piece of this case as it was gaining in popularity and even more so shrouded in mystery. Everybody wanted to know what happened to baby Sabrina. So the Eisenbergs take their story to Larry King Live, and in combing through the transcript of this live television event, I knew immediately that I was looking for the moment that Marlene and Steve Eisenberg became frustrated, causing one of them to slip and attempt to manipulate the situation to gain control. Of course, I found it. I looked for a shift in reality that was based in convenience, one that manipulated the truth. One of these parents loses their cool and then tries to hide it. Now, while Larry King is going to employ the kid gloves, you might imagine the rest of this panel, including Nancy Grace, might not be so diplomatic in their approach. The wild card, however, is Mark Kloss, father of now iconic child murder victim Polly Kloss, who came under heavy scrutiny by police in the same way, but cleared himself with absolute transparency in the effort to find his daughter. So what Mark Kloss understands going into this interview is that he's about to engage with two parents who have refused to take that path to the extent they pleaded the fifth in front of a grand jury. Now, the Eisenbergs take the stance that their innocence is not in doubt, and so they simply aren't going to cooperate any further because they've already answered the questions and have nothing to add. In fact, Marlene will go on to state in this interview that the couple answered all of the questions posed to them in the grand jury proceedings, but in reality, those answers enacted the right of the Fifth Amendment, so there was clearly no exchange of information in the questioning. They want the police to investigate other people, but they're pleading the Fifth in front of the grand jury, which is easily the worst possible move you could make in accomplishing that goal. Everybody thinks you're guilty once you've done that, because the truth is that you usually are. The purpose is to legally avoid saying it. So, of course, police and prosecutors involved in the case avoided appearing on the show, undoubtedly to limit their liability by not speaking about potential misconduct in the investigative process. This means the Eisenbergs get the opportunity to tell their story without rebuttal, which leads to an opening where Steve shortcuts the details of Marlene's activities that morning to simply say they woke up and she found the baby missing from the crib. Meanwhile, the most controversial part of their story is the trail of inconsistencies Marlene offered. So, Steve just paves right over them with a new road that leads to the disappearance. He then discusses that fingerprints were found on the backslider. And you'll have to forgive me here, but I still have no idea what that is, even after Googling it in the context of a component in a house, most probably a door. To the best of my understanding, he might be trying to say there were fingerprints on the sliding door at the back of the home that didn't belong to him or Marlene. Otherwise, I'm thinking of somebody who has foregone the word of God in favor of sin. But isn't it funny he used the term in that way? Anyhow, he continues with referencing the unidentified footprint on the bed ruffle beneath the crib, and then Marlene prompts him about the unidentified single hair found inside the crib. Larry King then goes on to suggest that the kidnapping was obviously not for ransom because the Eisenbergs weren't multimillionaires. And if that isn't the most assumptive thing I've ever heard, I'm not sure what is. I mean, people rob banks at immense risk of prison or death for sums lower than $5,000. The potential for somebody demanding ransom for a similar sum exists. People blackmail each other for these types of sums all the time. So I think Larry extended them a courtesy that wasn't entirely deserved. And then Steve goes on to assert that because the police dogs tracked Sabrina's scent from the back door to the fence across the yard, that it's evidence she was abducted in that manner. But if Sabrina had ever been in the backyard, which family photos prove was the case, then she'd have gone through that back door in someone's arms. And of course, it still sounds plausible, and I'd like to believe Steve Eisenberg. However, in addition to pleading the fifth to the grand jury, he and Marlene refused to be questioned separately after retaining attorney Barry Cohen, taking yet another page out of the Ramsey handbook. At that point, attorney Barry Cohen goes on to assert that the tapes drawn from the wiretaps are, quote, inaudible and pure fiction, but shortly thereafter has the audacity to say that the tapes prove that Brownie the dog didn't bark when strangers entered the home. If the tapes were inaudible, however, by definition, we would hear nothing. Even if I extend the attorney the benefit of the doubt that he more accurately meant indecipherable or lacking in clarity, he would still have absolutely no way of properly asserting that he could understand a situation transpiring in the tapes where a stranger was at the door and the dog was not barking. If he was, in fact, able to come to that understanding by way of the tapes, then it's likely the six grand jury indictments he speaks of were not handed down as a result of, quote, pure fiction. There was something convincing present, and there was enough clarity to make something out, as he himself did. So, at this point in the conversation, Mark Kloss accuses the couple of not cooperating and says it's a total disservice to put their own needs before their missing daughters. He then proceeds to call Marlene a liar by way of accusing her of changing her story three times and doesn't relent when Steve joins the discussion. I mean, Mark Kloss couldn't make it any more explicit or obvious that he thinks the Eisenbergs are hiding the truth. He seems disgusted by their actions and is more animated about his distaste for the dishonesty than everybody else, including Nancy Grace. This is the father of an abducted little girl who was murdered. If there was any way he could find it in his heart to sympathize with the Eisenbergs as victims, I have no doubt he would. he would know their pain. But he thinks they're full of shit, and says so on national TV to their faces. This wasn't a spontaneous reaction. He had time to carefully consider the situation. So, after witnessing those bold words on the part of Mark Kloss that defy Marlene's version of events and unabashedly assert her dishonesty in a public forum, Steve Eisenberg has the unfathomable audacity to close the show with the following statement directed at Kloss. Larry King asks, "Marlene and Steve, do you expect to see Sabrina again?" Steve Eisenberg replies, quote, "Yes, we do. And as a matter of fact, Mark, with all your clout out there and looking for missing children, we ask your help in finding our daughter and bringing her back safely to us. We think with people like you out there, your clout can help bring her home and getting her picture out there. Our sympathy goes out to you for what happened to you, and we know that you feel for us in our pain and hope that our daughter comes back safely." End quote. Are you out of your fucking mind, Steve-O? You and your wife just got owned on national TV by Mark Kloss for your dishonesty, and in return, you shower him with false praise for the insult, ask for his help when he just described you as uncooperative, and assert that he truly sympathizes with you when he clearly believes you're behaving improperly due to the fact you're lying to police. In short, he thinks you're guilty in the disappearance of your daughter, but you're framing the situation as though he could be the missing piece in the effort to finally bring Sabrina home. Really? That is manipulative beyond reason and desperately caters to perception at the exclusion of everything else. Mark Kloss tells them to clear themselves by cooperating, and they tell him they need his help in bringing their daughter home. Essentially, when Kloss accuses the Eisenbergs of being the reason the truth of their daughter's disappearance hasn't been realized, they turn it around on him and say he's the missing piece in the investigation, that somehow his lack of cooperation with the story they're telling is a roadblock to finding Sabrina. That's disgusting, convenient, and, notice the parallel, entirely consistent with what they accuse the police of doing to them. Steve Eisenberg unleashes this pathetic display of manipulation on national TV in the same way he roasts the cops, but when a grand jury asked him, the victim's father, about his involvement in the crime, he pleaded the fifth, knowing full well he'd never live down the scrutiny of that choice. That isn't something you do when you're innocent. It's something you do when you're desperate and talking can only get you in trouble. I mean, consider this. The grand jury returned 6 indictments without the Eisenbergs saying a word. Had they spoken on their behalf, even with lies, would the outcome have been worse? Probably not. When you get indicted for lying to police in a proceeding in which you elect to not answer any more questions, that's some serious shit, my friends. It says you won't tell the truth. But the bottom line is this. If you're innocent and continue to tell the police the truth, one of two things is going to happen. You're either going to be cleared or you're going to be falsely accused. If you're falsely accused, you can then retain an attorney with the comfort of knowing you have not implicated yourself in a crime because it's an impossibility outside of a false confession of some kind. The reason, however, that people like the Eisenbergs and Ramseys run to high-priced legal defense is because once you've gone through the initial questioning and the cops make it clear they're focusing on you, it means they're closer to learning the truth. We saw the Ramseys bail after the first 3 days of questioning, and the idea is to create a wall between the cops and the truth in the form of an attorney. What's happening is these people can't stand the heat, so they hire a lawyer and get out of the kitchen while he does the cooking. Then they take the suspicion that's been cast upon them and throw it back at the cops like it's their fault they needed a lawyer in the first place. But the Eisenbergs, just like the Ramseys, were engaged in an event where manipulation, dishonesty, and convenience clearly existed in conjunction with claims of ignorance on the part of the victim's parents. So, essentially what we end up with in the Eisenberg case is the Ramsey murder with the body hidden somewhere outside the home in an undisclosed location. Unless you believe Sabrina is still alive somewhere. But with the case having received national attention for 2 decades, and age-progressed photos of Sabrina regularly released, it's hard to believe she's above ground and smiling. At some point, somewhere, somebody would have recognized her and reported it, even if she didn't notice the coincidence herself first due to apparent differences between her and the people who raised her. Smartphones are everywhere now. But Sabrina is not. There hasn't been a confirmed sighting of her in 20 years. And the last one confirmed outside of the family was supposedly 2 days before her disappearance. We don't even have any proof of this baby actually being alive when Marlene went to bed the night before she disappeared. That doesn't speak well for the parents or Sabrina's odds of being alive at this point. But just as we thought this case had fizzled out, an informant comes forward in 2008 with a shocking story of murder. It's learned that a man, Scott Overbeck, believes he purchased a boat with no title from a woman whom he later came to believe was Marlene Eisenberg, and the trail ultimately leads to police informant Dennis Byron, who allegedly says the boat contained a newly created compartment, or console, where Sabrina's body was hidden. The corpse was then chopped up in pieces and left in crab traps in Thunder Bay, never to be seen again. Byron's girlfriend at the time, Carrie Lease, claims he told her these things and threatened to kill her if she ever repeated them. Eventually, Overbeck and Byron become cellmates in jail, and Byron secretly records what he says amounts to hundreds of hours of conversation between him and Overbeck, where the details of Sabrina's death and disposal are divulged. But did this really happen? It's certainly an interesting story, and a plausible way for a baby to disappear without any physical evidence left behind, as the claim is Marlene actually killed the baby once on the boat. Unfortunately, however, it hasn't been corroborated with evidence to an extent that it becomes useful in the eyes of the law. The story was never able to be verified as legitimate in any way, shape, or form, which isn't too odd in the arena of police informants, who are generally comprised of criminals and often lead the police down the yellow brick road to Fantasyland. And that brings us to today, when the Eisenbergs are still claiming they did nothing wrong and are still enjoying their freedom, albeit without Sabrina, whom they hope will return one day so that their family can finally be together again. Yet, if I examine this situation as closely as I can, in the absence of physical evidence, I can envision a number of scenarios, but not one where Sabrina Eisenberg is alive. I believe the circumstantial evidence shows there was not sufficient reason to blindly accept the notion an intruder entered the house and abducted her. Like the Ramsey case, the abduction was supposedly carried out by way of a convenience created directly by a family member, with the Eisenbergs leaving the doors open and the Ramseys leaving a broken window in disrepair in the basement. We don't have forced entry in either case, and they also both lack proof anybody but the inhabitants of the home were ever inside that night. It seems likely to me that this was not a premeditated murder by the Eisenbergs, but perhaps momentary loss of control that led to an event that left Sabrina in a condition from which she could not recover, perhaps in the same way JonBenet suffered a massive blow that incapacitated her, but left her still breathing. For instance, I could easily see Sabrina being shaken to tears before bed one evening, and then calming as though she was going to be fine, only to succumb to the injuries during the night, leaving Steve and Marlene in a situation where claiming an accident wasn't possible. I think that's the key. Just like it is in the Ramsey case, copping to the act wasn't a possibility because of the nature of how it occurred, even if it was due to a momentary loss of control on behalf of the guilty party. In the case of the Eisenbergs, however, I don't see any reason to believe their other children were involved. If I had to guess, I'd say Sabrina died during the night one day prior to the 911 call, and Steve and Marlene decided to dispose of the body during that time. Given the ability to buy a day without suspicion, and the abundance of waterways in the area, I believe the body was probably dumped in deep waters where it was easily preyed upon due to its small size, and subsequently became something that would never be detected by law enforcement, or even a fisherman dropping his line in the water. Just think about this for a moment. If Sabrina was kidnapped for the purpose of being raised by another family, it means that no one in that family, or anybody who knows them, or has even come in contact with them in the last 20 years, has suspected the child they acquired in the blink of an eye, who just so happens to be famous due to national exposure, was abducted. ask yourself which one of these things is more believable. Never hearing from Sabrina again because she got abducted to be raised by another family? Or never hearing from her again because she was murdered and has been dead for 20 years? My money is on murder, unless you can prove there was a kidnapper. In 20 years, there has not been one legitimate suspect other than Steve and Marlene Eisenberg. And continuing with the parallels to the Ramsey case, the same goes for them. There is not one legitimate suspect upon whom we could even begin to blame JonBenet's murder, other than the people who were in the house that night. These things don't happen because you're getting railroaded by police. They happen because you lie and attempt to coerce innocence from dishonesty. In totality, then, it seems there really isn't any truthful answer about what actually happened in this case that's available by way of evidence. But in the process of all the finger-pointing, lies, and manipulation exposed on behalf of the police and the Eisenbergs, the one thing we can say for sure is that Sabrina has been absent for every one of those days. She never learned to talk, or ride a bike, or have friends, or even wear a wedding dress. All of that was taken from her. Unless you believe she's still alive somewhere. But either way, much like JonBenet left the Ramseys so suddenly and never returned, Sabrina has done the same with her family. And no matter how those losses occurred, whether it was due to leaving a door open, a window broken, or the result of a momentary loss of control by another family member, none of the lives involved were ever the same. And I think that's part of what makes this case so intriguing. These incidents were fueled by neglect and ended with irreconcilable loss, no matter the truth of how the events unfolded. In the same manner as John and Patsy Ramsey after JonBenet's murder, Steve and Marlene Eisenberg endured relentless pressure from the police that seemed it would never end. So whether they left the door open or lost control, Sabrina's disappearance was a tragedy derived from the ignorance of their actions. And when I stop for just a moment and let silence overtake the room, I can feel the full weight of this burden, this imprisonment, this finality, with all of its pain. And so I ask myself, like the Ramseys, how the hell did the Eisenbergs get through this? How did they pull through to the other side, innocent or guilty? I mean, we almost have to admire people like the Ramseys and Eisenbergs, no matter how manipulative or disgusting they might be in our eyes, because they stuck together, no matter what. And so, as I examine documents with quotes from Marlene and Steve, what's apparent to me is an endless trail of plural pronouns tied to actions that really occurred in singularity, that were truly only tied to the movements of one parent. Yet whether that's the result of conspiracy, teamwork, or solidarity, it's entirely indicative of the fact they committed to overcoming this incredible adversity together. 20 years later, the Eisenbergs are still married, and their other two children, Monica and William, have grown to healthy adults under their care. So we might never know what happened during the early morning hours of November 24, 1997, when baby Sabrina disappeared from her crib, never to return. But what we can say for sure is that love remained. This family never quit on each other. They never broke, whether their words were the truth or vicious lies. And in the search for guilt, I believe it's more important to learn than it is to destroy, that the vengeance of a witch hunt pales in comparison to the rewards of a silver lining. So if the outcome in this case says anything about life, it's that we live in a great big mysterious world where we might never know the truth before our existence comes to an abrupt halt. One where we all end up silenced and alone like Sabrina. But in the meantime, through the sunshine, the rain, the tears, and the joy. We still have each other, and nothing could be more beautiful than that.